Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
We have a packed show this week. The first plane carrying government-sponsored Syrian refugees arrived in Canada with the Prime Minister on hand to greet them. Here to speak more about the government's refugee plan and our mission against ISIS is Defence Minister Harjit Sajjan.
The Trudeau government commits to a renewed relationship with First Nations, with the first order of business being an inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women. Here to speak more about this is Dawn Harvard with the Native Women's Association of Canada.
Interim Conservative leader Rona Ambrose is here to discuss the Tory adjustment to the opposition benches. We also speak with the photographer behind the Vogue photo shoot of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau that's created a bit of a controversy.
And finally, we check in with Nick Kohler about Senator Mike Duffy testifying at his own criminal trial. And we talk to the new Speaker of the House of Commons, Jeff Regan, about how he plans to reform the House.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Syrian refugees have arrived on Canadian soil. Late Thursday night, the first plane touched down in Toronto as a part of the Liberal government's plan to bring 25,000 refugees to our country by the end of February.
163 Syrians arrived here for their new life in their new homes. The first family to arrive at the terminal at Pearson Airport was a couple with their 16-month-old daughter. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was on hand to greet them.
Tonight they step off the plane as refugees, but they walk out of this terminal as permanent residents of Canada with social insurance numbers, health cards, and with an opportunity to become full Canadians. Now, this is something that we are able to do in this country because we define a Canadian not by a skin color or a language or a religion or a background, but by a shared set of values, aspirations, hopes, and dreams that not just Canadians, but people around the world share.
Through a translator, at least one refugee thanked Trudeau for taking them in.
We felt ourselves at home, and we felt ourselves highly respected. We felt ourselves humans. Really out of words, have to thank you.
You are home.
Thank you.
Welcome home.
Thank you.
This plan has been weeks in the making since the Liberals took government, and there's still a lot of work to do. To speak more about the refugee resettlement plan and Canada's mission against ISIS, I'm joined on the phone now by Defence Minister Harjit Sajjan. Minister, first off, you were there when those first refugees stepped off that plane in Toronto. Tell me what it was like for you.
Actually, for the first thing I saw were the all the Canadians with the different departments and volunteers who were there to ready to greet the volunteers, including some of our Canadian Armed Forces personnel. Their enthusiasm, just so excited to greet them. And then when the families came off the airplane, they went through their different procedures and finally got to the final step, which was picking up their clothing where we were. And the just the sincere enthusiasm on everybody's face and smiles on their face, and given that they had a very long flight and everything that they've gone through, just so appreciative of now they get to live in Canada.
Now, by the end of the weekend, your government will have brought over hundreds of refugees.
Yes.
But it does beg the question, how can you possibly still bring over 10,000 refugees by the end of the year?
We've been working with all the different departments, and my department has been supporting the efforts. There is a plan in place, and Minister McCallum has been doing a wonderful job of moving forward, and he's got phenomenal staff. That's what we took a lot, making sure our plan was done right. The processing centers in country there were staffed appropriately, and so now that work is done, it's time forward to basically get things moving, and there's a plan in place to meet that.
But you've had visa issues, you've had, and Turkey's a little bit different, you've had issues with them as well in trying to make sure everybody's approved to come over to Canada, and now with just 20 days or so left in the calendar, you'd have to bring over about 500 people a day. That seems like a lot.
Well, from the beginning, we said we're going to do this in a responsible manner, and There's, like I said, the plan in place. The processing is happening, and the planes are scheduled to arrive in. And we'll see what the date there. And I think the biggest thing would be to focus on is not just strictly the number, is the amount of people that that we are bringing in, and ultimately the entire plan of bringing 25,000 refugees is going to be met, and that's the real goal that we're working towards.
But the goal of 10,000 by the end of this year, and you still think you can hit that goal?
Oh, the goal still remains the same.
So, I mean, the first two trips were military transport, and the military has said that you're prepared to use bases if necessary to house the refugees coming over. So where are we with this? Is the military still going to be in need of providing assistance, or have you had enough private sector commitments that the military doesn't really need to take part in the housing or transportation anymore?
There is enough support that was identified by Minister McCallum from the provinces that it actually exceeded 25,000. Having said that, we want to make sure that there is no gap that can't be filled. And that's what we are providing, is making sure if more personnel needed for processing, as we've have identified and dealt with that early on, and even including for needing more airplanes for the transportation. And our bed spaces are available if it's absolutely necessary.
All right, let's talk a little bit about one of the reasons, anyway, that this whole refugee crisis really began, and that part of it is the issue with ISIS and the mission against ISIS. Many of our allies since the Paris attacks, like the UK, have now joined. France, the US are talking about increasing their efforts. But we're still planning on pulling out our CF-18s in terms of the bombing mission. Why would we pull out at a time where it seems like our allies are expressing that the need to fight ISIS like that is greater than ever?
First of all, when it comes to the refugee crisis, in terms of ISIS and its brutal ideology, what they're doing is they have created some of the refugee crisis. But we've got to be mindful, it's actually the civil war that Assad has started within his own country that has actually caused the major refugee crisis. So it's not directly, it's related, but not completely all, you know, one package here. Then the other piece, the second piece that you're asking about ISIL there, we're actually committed to the fight. Me being a former person in uniform, we get back to the conversation of one capability of our fighters that are being pulled out. We're to defeat something, a group like ISIL, it takes a much more sophisticated approach, and we're not the only ones part of this fight. In fact, we work as a part of a coalition, we work as a team, and when we look at the problem in its entirety, you need to bring different capabilities to the table, and as a threat evolves, you need to be able to evolve, adjust your support. That's what we are doing right now, making sure that we do it in a responsible manner so that you can actually defeat the enemy. Because if we just focus on, say, imagine if we just wanted to do the airstrikes, well, what about the other capabilities? Because I can assure you, airstrikes alone will not solve this problem.
The CF-18s, you do plan on pulling those out, but will the surveillance and refueling planes definitely stay? Can you clarify whether they will be staying there?
No, we have a wide range of capabilities that we bring to the table in terms of our intelligence and reconnaissance of platforms. But we have other capabilities as well, from our training and our ID awareness training as well. So there's many aspects that we can bring to the table, and all of those are being looked at of what to best bring to the table. And it goes back to understanding the entire picture and having those detailed conversations with the coalition is extremely important. So when we look at contributing, it's not just for the sake of making a quick decision for political expediency. We want to make sure if we're going to be sending our men and women into harm's way, and regardless of what they do in Iraq, we are sending them into harm's way. We want to make sure that their contribution is going to have a meaningful contribution to the fight against ISIL and the long-term solution to the problem.
Has there been a decision yet, yes or no, on the surveillance and refueling plans?
I've been asked a question in question period about this as well, And I've been clearly stated, I'm not going to give an answer until I'm fully, I have all looked at all the factors. And so I don't have a decision to decision on this. And when I do, I will make sure I announce it not only to in the House, but all to all Canadians as well.
That was Defense Minister Harjeet Sajjan discussing the arrival of refugees and the mission against ISIS. To listen to the full interview, head to macleans.ca.
Earlier this week, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau attended the Conference for the Assembly of First Nations, promising the chiefs that his government would renew the relationship with Canada's Aboriginal peoples. In a speech at a hotel across the river from Ottawa, Trudeau laid out his agenda for the Aboriginal file and spoke of his top priority.
It will be the creation of a national public inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in Canada. We have made this inquiry a priority for our government, because those touched by this national tragedy have waited long enough. The victims deserve justice, their families an opportunity to heal and to be heard. We must work together to put an end to this ongoing tragedy.
Later that day, his Aboriginal Affairs Minister announced the first phase will be a two-month consultation with families of victims, and the second phase will be the inquiry itself. More details will be unveiled in the spring.
For more about the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women, Maclean senior writer Laura Payton spoke with Dawn Harvard of the Native Women's Association of Canada.
When you're looking ahead to the next couple of weeks, what are the next steps?
Well, I know they're meeting today with the families, which is important that the families have that opportunity to have their voices heard and to be central, and that they start there. There's going to be meetings next week, and as the National Aboriginal Organizations, it's really important for us to be not necessarily united, but that we're working in partnership, that we all understand that we're working towards the same goal here, and I have seen that. I think this has become an issue where we all realize that this is too important to allow jurisdictional issues to get in the way. This is too important to allow political stripes to get in the way. This is too important for us to allow those kind of divisions that have happened in the past. So there is that commitment I have seen not only from the government to work with the Indigenous peoples, but as Indigenous peoples to set aside our differences, which, you know, there's huge diversity across the country. So there has to be differences, but willing to seek that commonality, because this itself is the biggest commonality. Our women are not safe. Our girls are not safe. And that is such, that is our common experience, and that is what we need to look at and keep our eye on that while we begin to address this. When we go into those meetings, we are going to be talking about, as we said, keeping open-minded about what might come up so that we can address it, that we can't be so narrow in our terms of reference that if something important comes out that we are so constrained that we would ignore it. So that flexibility and that responsiveness to what comes out of this in terms of making sure that we're not re-traumatizing families, not re-traumatizing those who have already been traumatized. But also something that's coming out more and more lately is, while the families have to be central, absolutely, there are many women who have come forward and said, I would have been number 1,182 on that list, but I survived. I escaped. I made it. And those voices are going to have to be heard as well, because those voices to tell us, to help us understand that experience, to help us know, you know, potentially what happened in the last days for those ones who are taken from us, we have some insight if those who have survived are able to come forward. And I think making sure that they have a safe place, and that's what's going to be important, is to have safety for those who need to come forward, because they haven't come forward until now because of the fear of retribution. Because you look at the situation in Val-d'Or, I think it's a good example of how women are afraid to come forward, because they fear that not only have they been beaten, not only have they been traumatized, that if they come forward and speak out, that they're going to be in even more danger. So making sure we're protecting them that way is going to be very critical.
Yeah, you mentioned Val-d'Or, where the police have allegedly sexually assaulted and physically assaulted the women there.
This is something that, in fact, as the situation in Val-d'Or came out, we've been hearing from women across the country that it was not just Val-d'Or. They said they completely believe it because that happened to them, whether they were in Thunder Bay. We've heard women saying that. I was in Saskatchewan, heard women talking about it there and saying that that happened to them. So I think once the doors have been opened, the floodgates on those conversations, we're going to see that there are women who are going to have the courage now to come forward because those brave women in Val-d'Or stepped up and came forward on this. We're going to see that it's going to come out across the country, that this is not just happening in Val-d'Or, it's happening across the country. And once again, that's because we now have a government that is willing to hear that. Up until now, they have denied, they have deflected, they have said this is not happening, they have silenced those voices, and I think we do feel now that there is a certain level of safety, that it's worth coming forward now because somebody's going to listen.
That was McLean senior writer Laura Payton speaking with Dawn Harvard of the Native Women's Association of Canada.
Still to come on the show, interim Conservative leader Rona Ambrose discusses the roadmap for the Tories. We speak with the photographer of the Vogue photo shoot with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau that's created some controversy. And we discuss Mike Duffy taking the stand.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSwiney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, we go behind the scenes for the Vogue photo shoot with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. We discuss Mike Duffy taking the stand in his criminal trial, and we hear from the new Speaker of the House of Commons. But first,
as the House resumed this week, most of the attention was directed on the new Liberal government. But interim Conservative leader Rona Ambrose also attracted some notice for the way she took over her party as it prepares to start its search for a replacement of Stephen Harper. Ambrose has counted herself out of the running for the Tory leadership, but she's still determined to put her own stamp on the party's style in the meantime.
McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes interviewed Ambrose in her Parliament Hill office, and she started off by explaining that being relegated to the opposition benches gives the Conservatives a chance to think about what they stand for.
I think it's just natural when you're governing that it's not always easy to remain as pure in principle as you'd like to be. And I think in opposition, it's an opportunity for us to get back to the principles of the Conservative Party and of the Conservative movement. And so when I talk about that, I talk about our opposition to big government, big spending, high taxes, high deficits. But I also talk about intrusive government. And that means more, it's not just about freedom, you know, fiscal liberty, it's about personal liberty too. And I think that's an area in which I think we could do more, could do more in terms of talking to Canadians about their individual liberty. There are things about our values that we should focus on more. And I think we've done that right out of the gate. And Conservatives expect that, and I think Canadians expect that.
What values? So how do you mean, like
that? You know, focusing on our core areas like the economy, focusing on areas of public safety, national security. All of those things are areas in which, frankly, most Canadians agree with us on, and not being distracted by some sometimes sort of boutique issues.
Do you think then the degree to which the kneecap issue became a point of emphasis in the campaign was a mistake? Should you have not done that?
I think that the kneecap issue got caught up in all kinds of other politics, and you know, I could blame the Liberal Party for that, for taking it and torquing it. But you know, there are issues where, you know, as a woman, I would stand my ground. You know, I don't want women that arrive in Canada that may have come from a country where they are oppressed to in any way feel like any of those cultural traditions in which they found themselves. You know, I lived in Egypt, so I saw this firsthand. That in Canada we don't condone that.
I got the impression from your speech today and from other things I've heard that the pulling Canada out of the fighter, the pulling of Canadian fighter jets out of the theater in Iraq and Syria, that is going to be a big deal for you. When people talk about new tone in the House, I think sometimes they forget that sometimes there are issues like that, which are serious issues, not trivial matters, that people feel strongly about, and that sometimes strong words and even harsh words have to be exchanged. do you not think that when we think about, oh, new tone, things will be nice, that we sometimes forget, like, shouldn't you reserve the right to say some harsh things about the government and them to fire back at you in a tough way?
They already did today.
I just wonder sometimes when we talk about wanting a new tone, are we missing the point that the tone, at times, sometimes the tone on something that it should be
that's still
intense and even angry at times? You know?
Absolutely, but that... I think when people talk about new tone, they mean negativity and nastiness and personal attacks. There's no need for those things.
Right.
But we're talking about assisted suicide. We're talking about dismantling all of the tough on crime legislation that puts really bad people away for a long time that are on the books, and the Liberals will dismantle that. We're talking about pulling our CF-18s out of the fight against what the President Obama calls the death cult. These are people that... throw gay and lesbians off the roof to their death. I mean, these guys are the most evil people. And if he's not willing to use airstrikes against ISIS, what does it take? So these are very emotional issues for a lot of us, for me in particular, around the issue of the human rights violations that are happening in Syria and Iraq, and our obligation and our responsibility to be part of that.
Joel, it's always been pleasant, this back and forth.
We have very contrasting viewpoints on national security, on defense, on taxation, on the size of government. This Liberal Party is a liberal party. I mean, this is not Paul Martin Blue Liberals. This party is almost as left as the NDP is in a lot of ways. When you listen
people
to the,
argued they ran to the left of the NDP.
I think, well, they did, and I thought there might be a little shift to the right. But not yet. I mean, his speech was interesting. Very, very left-wing. So we've got very contrasting agendas. So yes, there will be sparring in the House, and that's healthy.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with interim Conservative leader Rona Ambrose. For more of the interview, head to mcleans.ca.
Still to come, we speak with a photographer who shot the Vogue piece that has ruffled a few feathers. Senator Mike Duffy takes the stand in his own defense, and the new Speaker of the House of Commons sits down to discuss House reform.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we talk about the testimony of Senator Mike Duffy, and we hear from the new Speaker about how he wants to change the House of Commons. But first...
This week, Vogue magazine released a feature on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his wife, Sophie Gregoire Trudeau. McLean's was the first to report that Canada's new PM would have an article and photo shoot in the famous fashion magazine, and now it's out, with Trudeau and his wife posing in the Library of Parliament. The story became the top trending article on Vogue's website.
But it's created a bit of a controversy since Sophie accepted a dress on loan for the shoot worth about $5,600. It wasn't a gift, but some feel it was inappropriate for her to accept, while others say that's par for the course for shoots in fashion magazines. In an exclusive interview, McLean senior writer Laura Payton takes us behind the scenes of the Trudeau Vogue photo shoot with the photographer who took the pics, Norman Jean Roy.
Tell us a little bit about how this shoot came together. A lot of people, around Ottawa aren't that familiar with a Vogue photo shoot, for example. How long were you planning it?
Right.
And tell us about the concept behind it.
The shoot came about, Anna Wintour, who's the editor-in-chief of American Vogue, wanted to do a profile on the Trudeaus, on Justin, and really them as a couple. And then when they contacted me to do the assignment, because I shoot quite a bit for Vogue, they knew that I was Canadian, and I don't know how much of that played into it. But I certainly, when the call came, I immediately jumped on it because I had just been talking about Justin like the week before that. And as far as the concept of it, it's typical of how I approach my photo shoots. With someone like him, I really wanted to try to create a portrait that would stand, that would stand the times and not just kind of fade away into this kind of pop culture picture. So I really wanted to have I wanted the portrait of Justin to have reverence and importance and weight. And so we kind of chatted a little bit and sat him down and started taking pictures.
And how about the portrait of the two Trudeaus together? I mean, it's quite intimate. It's not something aside you see every day of a politician.
Yeah, that's it. Really is a reflection on what their relationship is like. I had been told by other people that they're close to the Trudeaus. They really are a dynamic couple that way, and they're very much have a wonderful relationship. And when he walked on set, and when she had been getting her hair and makeup, he hadn't seen her in a little bit, and I think he had just finished a press conference, and he came straight from the press conference across the street to us, and he had not seen her with hair and makeup and the dress on, and he was just kind of taken by it. It was a very real moment, and I just happened to have my camera, and he was sitting on set. I had been photographing him, and she walked on set, and it was very genuine. So it's not, that moment was not fabricated at all.
Was that a candid photo?
No, I mean, it was a candid photo in the sense that, all my photographs are relatively candid in the sense that I create an environment for a subject to operate inside, and then from there I just kind of capture candid moments or intimate moments where they can reveal themselves as honestly as possible. So in that respect, yeah, it's a candid moment, but it certainly, the light was there that he was in his position, and he just happened to be in the position I had been photographing him, so the light was right on, and she just came on, and it was right before we started doing portraits of the two of them together, and it was just they just kind of were chatting a little bit and gave her a big kiss, and it was this intimate moment that I had my camera and photographed them.
Wow,
they were gracious enough to let me do it too.
Yeah. You mentioned that you had been talking a bit with the Prime Minister's office about Mr. Trudeau and about the relationship between the Trudeaus. How involved was the Prime Minister's office, and how involved were the Trudeaus in working with you on the concept?
It's a fine line between doing a lot of research on your subject and having too much information so that you can't go in there with an unbiased eye. So I try to have just enough so that I can have superficial topical context, but not too much, so this way I can allow myself to discover them visually, because a lot of information is revealed with people in portraiture by just observing them, even in that first minute that you meet someone. People reveal a lot of themselves that moment, and if you pay attention to it, you can capture that. You get these incredibly powerful and intimate moments. So I wasn't necessarily, we had a time frame and some parameters that we could operate within, which were pretty, pretty defined for me, more than I usually like to, but with politicians and world leaders, it tends to be that way. But as far as the idea of what we were going to do, originally we were going to photograph in the library, and we got there and it was just too busy, and the light was, it was raining that day, so there was just no light. There was really nothing for us to work from, and I felt that photograph had already been done a million times anyway, so we had brought some backdrops, and we did that instead, which I kind of removed them from their environment, which is always a beautiful way to execute a portrait. Is by removing the environment out, so this way you can focus on the person and what you're trying to communicate with them.
That Oscar de la Renta dress caused a bit of discussion, partly because of the price and partly because it's not a Canadian designer. And so far, Ms. Grégoire Trudeau has worn a lot of Canadian designers. Can you discuss how was that dress chosen, and how do you choose clothes for a Vogue photo shoot?
Well, with Vogue, you certainly, all these things are, it's because it's a fashion magazine, and because here in the States, it really is a fashion Bible. You, Anna Wintour and the editors, the fashion editors will do run-throughs and go through all the different clothes that would work. And there are all sorts of reasons as to why they're chosen the way they're chosen. And it could be as simple as, this dress, we need to show this dress in this particular issue, and this designer didn't get enough pages, so we're going to do that. Or it could be as simple as Anna really wants that dress to be shot on her, and it's as simple as that.
That was Maclean senior writer Laura Payton discussing the Vogue photo shoot of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau with the photographer Norman Jean Roy. There's a longer version of this interview, and Payton has written about the Vogue feature. To access both, go to macleans.ca.
Coming up after the break, Senator Mike Duffy gives testimony at his criminal trial, and the new Speaker of the House of Commons tells us how he plans to change the way MPs do business.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with Maclean's Magazine.
After 8 months in court, this week, Senator Mike Duffy finally took the stand in his own defense at his criminal trial on 31 charges of fraud, breach of trust, and bribery. To speak more about the testimony from Senator Duffy, I sat down with Nick Kohler, who's covering the trial for Maclean's.
So, Nick, you and I have actually been sitting in the courtroom for all of the days of the testimony from Senator Duffy. Why don't you first start off by giving us your impression of how Duffy has been handling himself on the witness stand?
Well, I'm not sure I've ever seen a witness quite like him. He treats the witness box or the stand like a little space that it's perfectly normal to be a raconteur, to trot out anecdotes that may go on for longer than his own lawyer even would like to hear. He's a bit like being at Christmas and you're sitting next to your uncle. And although he's sort of a lovable guy, you'd maybe prefer to talk to somebody else after the first 10 minutes.
Why is that? Why do you give that analogy?
Because there is an avuncular quality to Mike Duffy, and there is somebody who clearly enjoys the sound of his own voice. I mean, why not? He was a broadcaster for so many years. He's excellent at it. And yet, when he talks about the business of government, what he was up to as a senator, it can be a little tedious.
In terms of what's coming up, what we're hearing in the testimony, what have you noticed?
Well, look, I think that Duffy's lawyer, Donald Bain, who has been directing the examination in chief over these past 3.5 days, has been hammering away on whatever Duffy spent money on. It would appear within the rules that it was public business, that there was no personal benefit going to Duffy, and that he was undertaking the business of the Senate, but also of the government in power at the time, that is the Stephen Harper conservatives.
So it was within the rules. Is that something that is being hammered on exhaustively throughout this trial, going over? Because they're going over every single travel claim right. that he ever touched and almost every meeting right. that surrounds those travel right. claims.
I mean, it's really, this trial has been going on for 8 months with a few breaks, and all of the material that the Crown presented us over those 8 months and presented the court is now being sort of channeled through Mike Duffy, the witness, and he's being asked by his lawyer, Donald Bain, to sort of describe bit by bit what he was up to. Therefore, it's a long process. But I think that Bain, it's a valuable process for the defense because I think Bain has been successful in showing that even in those cases where there was a personal dimension to the travel, let's say, or other things, there was very much a public dimension too. That's the strong suggestion. And I think that the Crown is going to have a little bit of trouble disentangling the personal benefit that they allege is behind some of these expenses or the expenses that the counts are related to and anything else.
And since it is a fraud case, I guess they're trying to solidify the narrative of the intent was never for personal gain.
That's clearly the case. The Crown closed its case, let's say 3.5 days ago, it's been an erosion, I think, of its case over the course of Duffy's witness, Duffy's testimony. For example, the Kerry Blue Terrier dog that he was alleged to have gone to Peterborough on the public dime to buy, that component of the Crown's case has pretty much fallen apart, I think, at this point. And so, yeah, I mean, Bain is doing a good job of directing that.
Now, throughout his testimony, I mean, there was a lot of anticipation politically that now former Prime Minister Stephen Harper and his Conservative Party would be a prominent feature throughout the testimony. And his name has popped up, or at least the Conservative Party name has popped up, at least once each day in his testimony.
Yeah, that's right. And it's been really the most interesting stuff, I think, for the journalists in the room. But I think that there's also a rationale. Why is Mike Duffy talking about the Prime Minister at the time, Stephen Harper? Why is Bain, in many cases, prompting it? So let's go through some of these things. Stephen Harper wanted to appoint Mike Duffy a senator at the same time as he appointed people like Nancy Green, Patrick Brazzo, Pamela Wallin, another well-known broadcaster, not to fundraise, which has always been the story behind these particular senators, particularly Duffy and Pamela Wallin, but to quote-unquote, expand the pool of accessible voters. In other words, Canadians in 2009, when Duffy was appointed or sworn in as a senator, were very distrustful of Stephen Harper and his Conservatives. They were not giving him a majority government, the majority government that he wanted. And Harper, according to Duffy's testimony, saw people like Duffy and Wallin as friend-raisers, to use Duffy's terminology, as people who could give third-party validation and say, look, if those people are good with the Prime Minister, if they think that he's a good guy, well, then maybe we should rethink Harper and his Tories.
That was Nick Kohler, who's covering the Duffy trial for Maclean's. To read his daily pieces, go to Maclean's.ca.
When Parliament began last week, the first order of business was to choose a new Speaker of the House of Commons. Longtime Liberal MP Jeff Regan was elected by his peers to be the new referee of the House, as the government promises to reform the way our members of Parliament do business. To speak more about his plan for the House, I sat down with the new Speaker.
Do you see your style differing at all from any of your predecessors, or the speakers, specifically the speakers you've served in Parliament with?
That's probably best for others to determine as time goes on, as maybe some can already detect differences in style. But I will bring my own personality, my own approach to this. And I've watched speakers over the 18 years that I've been a member of Parliament, and I will try to learn from what I've seen. It's clear to me that it's not as easy to do as it is to criticize, and it's easy to watch, you know, from the rows, and think, well, that should be done differently. Much easier to do that than it is to sit in the chair. For instance, sometimes trying to figure out which member has just said something, you know, with their heckling, for example, is hard to do, because you're watching the person who's speaking, and over here somewhere else among the 338 members in a house that stretches down a ways away from the speaker, it's, you know, figuring out who that was. It's a bit like a referee in a sense. It struck me the other day that it's kind of like in a hockey game when the referee hears the first whack and sees the second one. And so only one of the players, you know, gets penalized for that.
Right.
And sometimes someone falls down on this and the referee thinks it was a penalty when it wasn't.
Right.
So you've got to be careful of that. But you know, the referees and speakers are imperfect.
The one thing you said in your speech that I thought was interesting was you said, I believe the speaker should lead discussions about how to reform our procedures. So do you see yourself taking a very active role in that discussion?
I think that in the discussions that I have with House leaders, that it is important for me to try to encourage them to come up with ways amongst themselves, or with ideas that I've heard from members to improve the way this place works, and to ensure that MPs have a real say in government decisions. And the, you know, I see some moves in that direction, the idea, you know, of hopefully having more independent committees, things of that nature. But I'm interested in seeing how that develops. I've had members suggest various things to me that I then raise with House leaders and say, what about this? And in the end, if you're going to change any rules, well, that's a decision for the House to come to, which is usually led by the House leaders by their agreement. And we, you know, of course, we've seen over the years a variety of things happen that way. So I hope to see more of that.
How are there specific areas that concern you?
Well, I think that Canadians want to see their members of Parliament actually be somewhat independent and be able to speak their minds and even have differences of opinion within political parties. I understand the difficulty with that because frankly, if that happens, a big fuss of it is made, you know. You want members to engage in real debate and not simply speak on behalf of whatever their party's position is. And while members are going to speak on behalf of their parties, you hope that they will actually also engage in discussion. And for me, and this is a lot to ask, but part of that is encouraging members to hear the other arguments, to consider the thought that none of us has an exclusive hold on the truth.
Does that, leading that discussion, is that mainly something that will occur in private, or do you see yourself speaking publicly about some of the issues around Parliament and some of the ways that it might be improved?
I guess time will tell, but I on the issue of decorum and behavior in Parliament, some of that I'm already speaking on in the House, so that is public. Right. And as I said in my speech, I can't do that alone. I mean, you know, I am anxious to see an improvement in behavior. I can do part of that, but if members really don't want that to happen, then it won't. Right. However, I think Canadians feel very strongly about that. And I hope, actually, that they, over the coming months, will speak to their members and actually congratulate them on the positive tone we've had so far and let them know how important it is to them to see that improvement and how pleased they are. Because I think that the best way to modify behavior is with positive reinforcement. And now there are a number of tools that the speaker has, but I hope to use much more of the carrot than the stick.
There has periodically been conversations about whether members should be named and tossed out of the House for, you know, heckling and such. Do you see yourself quickly moving to that kind of thing? Or when you say you have a light touch, do you imagine sort of not being very reluctant to sort of toss people?
You should be reluctant to, and that's the ultimate sanction the speaker has. And in fact, you have to be careful when and how you use that. We've seen speakers not use it lately because what speakers saw previously was that it could play well for the person who was thrown out,
right,
that it could make them a martyr and help them make the case they were making against the other side. So you have to figure out, okay, when is that the right tool? I think there are other ways to deal with these things. And when it comes to members who are persistently heckling, first of all, as I said, I will hope Canadians will encourage them when they see the House performing well. And also that reinforces how important this is to them. But I can envisage a time conceivably when I ask the constituents of a member if they might be interested in contacting his or her office to let them know how they feel about the fact that this member is speaking out or yelling when they don't have the floor and someone else has the floor.
That was the new Speaker of the House of Commons, Jeff Regan, discussing his plan to reform the way business is run in the House. To read more of my interview with Speaker Regan, check out my article at macleans.ca. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.